Technical Net meets most Sunday evenings, and an enthusiastic crew in the New York City area get together and discuss their favorite hobby, ham radio. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You only need to sign in if you do have a question or a comment. After 28 years and 1 month, going on 2 months, we accept the fact that there are people out there listening. And the Technical Net has lasted this long because there's lots of brain power in this area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, where there's almost always someone with experience on a particular subject that's being questioned. The subjects that are discussed on the Technical Net are the questions that you guys bring to the Technical Net. We have some carryovers from last week. Whiskey 2 Echo Oscar named Bill. If he signs in tonight, he goes to the top of the list because we didn't get a chance to get to him last week. Ed K2GJE mailed me a very nice copy of the article we were discussing last week in Ham Radio Magazine, a article on how to measure the permeability characteristics of ferrite materials. And that's the one that Mel was mentioning. It was a ham radio article, and we now have a copy of that and understand how it works. We sign in ahead of time, John and Wesley. John and Wesley are conducting a rather extensive experiment of investigating magnetics. John mailed me a copy of the magnet that he's using. Wow, are they potent. My goodness.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You got to be careful with these things. This is Don Strong. You can get yourself in trouble pinching your fingers, breaking things, and if anyone ever made the mistake of swallowing one, wow, could you get in trouble? So magnetic field in general is something that is rather poorly understood by the majority of electrical engineers. I'm slowly coming to the conclusion that how an antenna launches a signal is primarily magnetic first, electronic second. I'll be discussing that sometime either later in this net or in other nets, but I'm slowly concluding that the magnetic field is what really launches the signal. And to study magnetics has an awful lot of merit because it's an area where we know rather little as engineers. I, as an electronic engineer, studying, 6 solid years, so to speak, of undergraduate and graduate level courses in New York City schools, when I think back, there was only 1 or 2 courses in that whole 6 years that covered the subject of magnetics. All of the courses studied electronics. And you think that electronics is where it happens. Yes, the electronics amplifies the signal. You can store electrical energy in a battery. You can you can put it through an operational amplifier. You can do all kinds of fancy things with electronics. But the electronics does not do the work. The work is done by magnetics. We sort of ignore that. That beautiful electronic signal, you send it to your earphones. Magnetically, it gets coupled into something that does work, and that's where the sound is created. If you have an electrically operated car, the electronics provides the energy to the motor, but the motor moves by magnetics. That's where the work is really done. The electronic supplies the spark that tells the fuel mixture in the cylinder when to fire, but the real energy is coming from the fuel, not from the electronics. So,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
As you can tell, there's a lot of reason to study magnetics. And what these guys are doing, John and Wesley, is getting pretty serious about it. They're putting their money where their mouth is. They're buying some very expensive equipment. They've got some lofty goals. Anybody doing research is going to have some goals, not all of which are met, not all of which are achieved. That's the normal process of doing research. You can't predict that what you're going to get. Some of it's going to be a surprise. It's unknown. It's the reason why you're doing research. If you knew exactly what you're going to get ahead of time, it wouldn't be research. It would be production. These guys are doing research. As I said, they're buying some pretty expensive equipment. They're getting pretty heavy into it. And some people object to the fact that these guys are on as much as they are. I don't think you should do that. As I said, you're in on listening to the process of the multi-months of research that they're going to be doing. You can be part of it if you want to. And I recommend you consider it. Try not to show any prejudice. We've all got prejudice. We'll get into that later.
expectations that before we begin.
Okay, yeah, Mel. Before we begin, go ahead and ask your question about clarification.
Well, seems to be some controversy arising here. I got it this morning on the TechNet, and now I see it also via email, about the use of getting on LimeOx repeater to the fact that I don't know who they are, supposedly some officials of the LimeOx Repeater Association that said that it's only going to be open to, they really only want full-time members, over.
Some of the members from time to time have had an opinion like that. Is it the general policy of the overall club? We'll have to ask the current president, Rich K2KKN, TKN, you know who I mean, whether or not that is absolutely true. Various members from time to time will express an opinion like that. According to the repeater guide, the 146.85 repeater, known as LimeOx, is considered an open repeater. That's the way it's listed. If it's a non-open repeater, and it's been listed that way for 20 solid years, is that in error? Is it an open repeater or a non-open repeater? You can't be half pregnant, if you know what I mean. I think it is an open repeater. Open for the general use of people in the area. Of course, people will be encouraged to join if they're using it a whole lot and they're not members. But still, I think it's an open repeater. I wonder if anyone has an opinion on that. Give me a call, letters right now. K2RA.
Do you own it? You're a black freeloader. Hello, freeloader.
Okay. Do you want the freeloader to leave?
Yes.
Okay. Bring it up for a vote.
KC2WGB.
Go ahead, John.
I don't think they can be forced to pay up, but anybody who's not willing to pay the few dollars that they ask to get this kind of an encyclopedia available almost 24 hours a day, I personally think they have to be out of their mind. That's about all I got to say. What do you think?
I understand, John. Okay. This controversy from time to time. As you guys know, if you've listened around long enough, about 15 years ago, there was a person who wanted the TechNet removed from this particular repeater. The person had the opinion that Sunday is a day of rest, and the person was, they thought, required to do monitoring of the repeater and didn't want to monitor all Sunday. Wanted the repeater to be quiet. Well, it's a resource that's not being used. And not all people of all faiths will consider Sunday the day of rest, or to consider it the Sabbath. That is, as you know, was not a successful effort. But no matter what you do, no matter how much benefit you bring to people, you're never going to make everyone happy. And that's a given. It's going to be a certain percentage of the population that disagrees, no matter what it is. And so those who make judgment will have to decide, is the benefit greater than the risk? Is the benefit greater than the detriment? And if so, the club who owns the repeater will have to vote among its members as to what they would desire to happen. This particular technical net apparently is producing more benefit than detriment, obvious by the fact that it has recently won a national award, which was nominated by Alan, KC2RFN. That award is going to be issued at an award ceremony next month in, I think it's Paramus, New Jersey. So there are people at the national level who think the technical net is providing a service. A person doesn't have to listen to it if it makes them unhappy. Let me drop.
K2KND.
Okay, I'll pass it over to you in a second there, Rich. Each of our synthesized receivers have got 800 channels. You don't have to listen to this particular one. You don't have to listen to 2 meters. You can listen to 450. Those who disagree are trying to gain control over something. Well, we all would like to have control over things. You're probably not going to get that control in most situations. But go ahead, Rich. K2KNB, K2RIW.
And I have a quick question.
Hi, thank you, Jim. Well, I just got a phone call, and apparently there's a tone of sort of conversation going on, which is apparently something that surfaces every once in a while. But apparently somebody is promulgating that LimeOx has some policy. LimeOx has no policy with regard to only LIMOC members using the repeater, only LIMOC members participating in a test net or anything to the like. Just to be clear on the policy, anyone can use the LIMOC repeater. And it's only when people use the LIMOC repeater for a prolonged period of time that we say, look, it costs us money to run this repeater, to keep it at the level that it's at, and that's why we ask you to join. But to say that you have to be a LIMOC member to enjoy the benefits of this TechNet is just absolutely not the truth. Dick?
Thank you, Rich. So, as I hear it, it really is an open repeater, and as a gentleman's agreement, you're asked to join if you happen to use it a whole lot. John, you wanted to make a comment? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Thank you, Dick. I also think, I believe it would be foolish to have that kind of a policy, because I believe the TechNet is one of the reasons people are joining this repeater association. And, you know, they hear us, what we're doing, then they start using this repeater, and I think it's more of a draw than it is a detriment to it. That's about all I have to say. Back to you, Dick.
And there's a man with good taste. And thank you, John. Check's in the mail. That was left-handed humor. Maybe I shouldn't be doing that. But we have reason to believe, by way of the letters and emails that Mel and I and others get, that a significant percentage of those who listen are pleased with the results. There appear to be more people pleased than those that are displeased. There always are going to be people displeased. Whenever you cover this much real estate, this many square miles, with this high a population density, a certain percentage of the people are going to be unhappy, and their prejudice starts showing. I'm giving you guys opinion now. Let me drop it. The easiest thing in the world is to demonstrate a prejudice. I'm going to be very brutal on this one, and that is people can easily be prejudiced and get angry about the fact that I'm so darn long-winded. I understand that. My motivation there is to try to explain to the newer members how things really work, and it takes time to do that. If you're an older person who's been around ham radio for a long time, you say, gee, I've heard that already, I don't want to listen to it again. As I said earlier, you're not forced to listen. In fact, you could, if you want to be super efficient, use the website where everything is recorded by this very enthusiastic guy, Mike Perry, KC2NJI. He runs a thing called amateurradio.tangovictor. And you can go there and listen to the recordings and skip through the sections that contain material you don't want to go through. And therefore, it's like skipping through advertisements, if you know what I mean. But there's various kinds of prejudice. There are people who are prejudiced because somebody has a foreign accent. That's silly, but we've got that kind of a prejudice. There are people who are prejudiced because somebody is long-winded or talks softly or whatever. So try not to let your prejudice show if you can tell. And as I said, when research is taking place, you don't know what you're going to get. And some of the goals are not going to be successful. That's a given. You don't know, otherwise you wouldn't be doing research. And some of the guys who signed into the TechNet have a scientific bend to their personality. Let me drop. They like researching on antennas and transmitters and transmission lines. And now, as I said before, Wesley and John are doing what I consider rather pure research on magnetics, an area where we're all very light on knowledge. And as I said later on, I'll explain to you my steps of thinking that have suddenly led me to believe that much of the radio waves that we're very interested in, the wireless technique, so to speak, really that signal is being launched from the antenna primarily as a magnetic wave. Of course, that sounds controversial. I'll tell you the evidence of why I've come to that conclusion in the last week later on. Right now, we're in the sign-in period. As I said before, if W2EO signs in, because we didn't get to him last week, he goes to the top of the list. Mel has signed in. Are there others who sign in because they have a question or a comment? We've already got John and Wesley signed in. Anyone else? Because they got a question or comment, give me a call, letters, and name right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
This is WS2N, Paul, with a space report. Good evening, Dick.
Pretty fine, Paul. Looking forward to your space report, and let's hope that you also have a question or a comment when it comes to your period. Your time. Anyone else this time, give me your call letters and name at this time. With that yes, meaning you've got a question or a comment. My goodness, you guys must be all tired because of that flea market. In fact, let me start off that way. Those who attended the flea market, and I intended to be there, but a crisis occurred in my family and I wasn't able to. Those who attended the flea market, who would like to give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch as to what they saw, what they bought, any suggestions for improvement, give me your call letters right now if you want to discuss the flea market that took place at Levittown Hall this morning. K2RIW listening.
No.
K2KNB, Dick.
Go ahead, Rich. And too bad you had so few people there that the place was so empty. That was a left-handed joke. You've got it, Rich.
Thank you, Dick. And this is K2KNB. And I know that that is comments that people make. You know, until you've actually run a ham fest, you have no idea of just how difficult it is. You know, first of all, to get the best vendors there, and then to hope that you're going to have an attendance that will justify the vendors. And in asking the vendors, the vast majority of them had a good day, even though our attendance was off by maybe, well, not totally sure, maybe about 30 or 40 people. And it is interesting, some people expressed that for Halloween, they would not be coming out, which I understand, grandparents taking kids out and so on, parents taking kids out. Anyway, I think from the vendor's point of view, it was very successful. We had a lot of buyers there. I think a lot of good equipment. I think a lot of the junk that had shown up from time to time was not there. I believe we had in excess of 400 people taking all people into account, probably almost 450 people. And I think for this time, the stage of the economy, I think that was pretty good. Back to you, Dick.
Was Andy busy with his tune-up clinic? And that's where I intended to station myself if all was well. Once you had a chance to visit Andy, Rich, go ahead.
Andy's clinic is always busy, I think, for a couple of reasons. Number one, there are people that obviously do bring their rigs to Andy to be checked. And I think the other thing is that a lot of people, myself included, don't have a lot of experience looking at test equipment really in use. Now, I've had service monitors here for a variety of reasons, but on a very limited scale, the very tip of the iceberg for my purpose to use. And I think people enjoy watching Andy go and give a unit its real test. I think they like watching lines and hearing bells and whistles and things like that, and I think that has a lot to do with it. So yes, Andy was busy pretty much from beginning to end.
Yeah, for those who don't know what we're speaking about, Andy, WA2CDL, has for many years at each of the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club functions supplies free of charge, call it a consulting service, where your transmitter will be checked for its deviation, power output, whether or not the modes work correctly, frequency accuracy, amount of PL tone accuracy, and so on. In other words, to make your FM, sideband, AM rig really perform the way it's supposed to, the way the manufacturer intended, he comes along with the test equipment, primarily a service monitor, a power meter, and power supplies, and checks them out. And he supplies that service free of charge. The price is right. So lots of people take advantage of that. All of us from time to time will have a intermittent microphone, improperly set PL tone, and so on. And that can be detected and corrected right there. And he supplies that service. Okay, anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment for the Technical Net, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
K2RIW. This is K2EFG Mobile in San Antonio. Checking in, I'm just listening.
Okay, Mr. EFG in Staten Island. Glad to hear that the signal is getting there. Okay, let's see what the latest progress is with Wesley and John. John mailed me a copy of the magnets, one of the things that he's experimenting with, and they are neodymium-type magnets these days, rare earth magnets that have an amount of magnetic strength that's just out of sight. My goodness, can you get yourself in trouble with these? When you use that kind of hardware in a brushless DC motor, for instance, and I've seen many of those in operation at the radio control model events, like the NEET Fair, N-E-E-T, I think it's Northeast Electro-Aero Technology, that has a NEET once every year now in September in Chinhopple, New York, which is the Western Catskills. And if you have the slightest interest in radio-controlled, electronically powered model airplanes, no gas engines at all, my goodness, can these things do things like you just wouldn't believe. Can you imagine a radio-controlled model airplane that can climb straight out of sight in about 5 seconds, or can go whipping across the field at 150 miles an hour with maneuverability like you wouldn't believe? And some of these things are running numbers like 5 horsepower of electronic motor engine, no reciprocating internal combustion engines inside. So these super magnets, can they do things? That's part of what Wesley and John are experimenting with. They have reason to believe that some great benefits can come out of this, and I welcome the research that they're doing. No matter what kind of science research you do, as long as it's being done with reasonable objectivity, and whether or not your experiment is successful or unsuccessful as far as your current goals are concerned, once you gather that data, you find out an awful lot about
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout.
You find out a lot about what Mother Nature is really telling you and how things really work. Every bit of knowledge that previously was unknown is really valuable. And so there are people who are telling Edison, boy, are you wasting your time. You think you're going to make an electronically operated source of light. Don't you know everybody knows that you only get light when you've got fire? And you're trying to make a device that gives off light but doesn't use fire. And how's it going? And his answer at the time to that particular reporter was, well, I know 3,000 and some odd things that don't work. I'm making progress. And he eventually found a solution, as you know. So you got to be careful how you judge what you think is junk science. There is no such thing. Objectively gathered information with the right kind of instrumentation, done in an objective manner where you're not lying to yourself, and you're keeping good notes, and you're not throwing out the so-called outliers. Very rarely are there really outliers. You'd be amazed how many times somebody has thrown away the baby with the washwater, scientifically speaking, because he wanted a particular result, and anything that didn't confirm that result, he threw it out and didn't bother recording it. You can't do that. As long as you're being objective, any science is good science, is a attitude that I have, and I see some merit in it. So let me turn it over to Wesley first and see how things are going. I bet if I know you, you've acquired a couple of more machines, a couple of more significant toys since we've last talked to you. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I'll take it for Wesley. I just dropped him off at the airport. He is on his way to Poland. He'll be there approximately 2 weeks, so we won't be hearing from him tonight. I have two questions, and the second one I'd like to defer until after Mel is through, because I know the young people have to get to bed, so it's important we take care of them. So if you wish, I'll give you my first question.
Fire away, John, and thank you for those magnets. My goodness. By the way, the ones that shattered when you let them come together, was that the quarter-size magnets? And I have never seen magnets quite that strong before. You got it, John.
Dick, I did you a favor. I put two Teflon washers between them because I don't know if you took them apart yet, but once those quarter-sized ones go together, they're tough to get apart. You also should have received a broken one that I had taped up. That was a much smaller magnet, but yes, one of the smaller magnets broke and one of the quarter-sized magnets broke also. I couldn't find the broken pieces of the larger one to send you at that time, but if you saw that one that was broken, the small one, they were held about 5 inches apart, both of them, and I let one go. It jumped over to the other hand. When it struck the magnet, it just broke. It just shattered. It's amazing. The hardness must be tremendous.
Yeah, I certainly did take them apart. I did make the mistake of allowing them without the two fiber washers. I think they're Teflon washers or nylon washers. When they come together, it took an extremely strong knife going between the two to separate them. I also had some fun finding out what around my house is magnetic. And there are certain pieces of stainless steel silverware, so to speak, I've got, where I get an extremely strong magnetic, extremely weak magnetic attraction. There must be very little iron in one of those stainless steel spoons that I own. But I didn't realize that the little ones, I know that there were a bunch of little ones that were separated from the big ones with chunks of paper. I assumed that those were three different size magnets. I didn't study the little ones enough to realize that there were both little ones and a broken little one. But magnets like that, my goodness, can they do things? Can you imagine magnets that strong, little pieces of them made as an armature, and you can either have an outracer or an inracer, as they say. In other words, the rotating armature on a brushless DC motor. The armature can be the most outer portion of the motor, and it rotates, or the inner portion of the motor as an armature that rotates. And there's an advantages and disadvantages of each. But with the right kind of electronic circuits firing the coils on the stator portion, the non-moving portion of a brushless DC motor, you can get any position, any speed, any direction that you desire. And I've seen those motors run up to 40,000 RPM on a ducted fan type, what looks like a jet engine, radio-controlled electronic model airplane. My goodness, can they do things. Go right ahead with your first question, John. KC2WGV, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Approximately 2 months ago, you were speaking about the application and use of a bird watt meter. And it's funny, I had two conversations this week with Tex about the use of it. And you had mentioned that apparently some of the technicians, some of the hands, will take a bird watt meter, let's say they'll be on the 200-watt scale, and they'll look at their SWR, and they'll look at the reflected and be very low. And then they go to put a lower slug in it, a lower wattage slug, in the reverse mode to read it, and you said that shouldn't be done, and I couldn't explain to them exactly why. I didn't know what the exact reason was, so I told them I would check with you. So, see if you can give me that answer again. I should have wrote it down with my weak mind. I couldn't remember. Over to you, Dick.
Don, good question, and you're in good company, John. Very few, very small percentage of the RF electronic engineers have a good working knowledge, by my standards, as to how a directional coupler, how a counter-directional type, that means non-waveguide type, directional coupler works. If you took a NADA directional coupler, which, by the way, in theory of operation, is identical to the slug of a bird watt meter, that's why I'm going to explain this. So you take a conventional type of NADA brand name, a very popular brand name, directional coupler. It's the one usually with a blue body and a red label on it. And it's got type N connectors, and two of those connectors are the what I call the straight-through line. You take that thing apart, you open up the upper cover, and you'll see a piece of strip line suspended in air going between the input connector and the main output connector, and in between that's essentially a 50-ohm piece of strip line in air inside that unit. Parallel to that, or half an inch or so to the south of that parallel line, to that straight through line, is another line. That's the directional coupler pickup line. And depending on how close you space the second line to the first line, the directional coupler is declared, let me drop, it's declared as either a 10 dB coupler, a 20 dB coupler, a 30 dB coupler. As you increase the spacing between that second parallel line and the first line that goes straight through, you decrease the amount of energy that's coupled from the first line to the second line. When that second line is properly designed, that really means it has the right characteristic impedance of its own, not exactly 50 ohms, and the right spacing, you then end up with a property called directivity. In other words, let's assume now that my main input connector is the upper left-hand corner of this rectangular box. My main output connector is the right-hand upper corner. And I've got two other connectors, bottom left and bottom right, which connect to both ends of the second parallel line. The way that directional coupler works, when you've designed it correctly, for a signal that flows on the main line from left to right, you will get a sample of that signal on the coupled line from right to left. That's why it's called a counter-directional coupler. And even a good, respected book like Krauss's book on electromagnetics sometimes get it backwards. They show it the wrong way around. So a signal flowing from east to west, from west to east on the main line will, on the coupled line, come out 30 dB weaker, 20 dB weaker, depending on the coupling coefficient, and it will be flowing from east to west in the opposite direction. And it comes out of that connector, you get a sample of it, and you know, therefore, something about what's going on the main line. You're taking a small sample of the signal, and you're doing it in a directional manner. Usually, there is a 50-ohm termination on the right-hand side of a coupled line. That's if I want to use it in the conventional manner. I could, if I want to, reverse the procedure. I can put the termination on the coupled line on the left-hand side and sample the coupled line.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And sample the coupled line on the right-hand side. If I did that, I would now be looking at only the energy that flows back down from right to left on the main line. If I was using the directional coupler to measure standing wave ratio, I could couple it the conventional manner. In other words, right-hand side of the coupled line is terminated, left-hand side goes to my instrumentation. I take a sample reading of forward power. Then I disconnect the directional coupler from left to right, turn it upside down, so that now the coupled line is giving me an answer from its right-hand side, so to speak, and the left-hand side is terminated, and now I can measure reflected power coming back down. Remember, it's always counter-directional. Well, let's assume now that I've got it in the reverse direction. I'm looking at power coming back from the antenna, because I intend to measure standing wave ratio, which really is reflected power ratio once you redo the mathematics, so to speak. While I'm doing that, bear in mind that my transmitter is still cranking out a kilowatt. I still have power flowing up the line. That power is still being coupled by the directional coupler into that dummy load. So if I was using, let's assume now it's a 10 decibel directional coupler, and I'm running a kilowatt, 100 watts would be flowing into that dummy load, and maybe the power being reflected back down from the antenna is only 1 watt, and therefore my coupled line on the right-hand side, I would read a tenth of a watt, because it's a 10 dB coupler. So reflected power is 1 watt. I'm sensing a tenth of a watt, which represents that 1 watt of reflected power, on the right-hand side, but that termination on the left-hand side, because it's a 10 dB coupler in my example, is absorbing 100 watts, one-tenth of the power flowing forward, a kilowatt. Doesberg wattmeter slugs.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Doesberg wattmeter slugs work by that exact process, and they go one step further. The directional coupler that you took apart that got the Nauta brand name on it has a certain frequency range, which usually is one octave. If I had the X-band version, it's rated from 8 to 12 gigahertz, which is almost an octave. And over that frequency range, it gives the desired directional coupling characteristic, 10 dB, we'll say, and a slight variation of that across the, with a sort of a the top of a sine wave curve to it, if you know what I mean. It's a gentle curve. And another point I was going to make. I've forgotten that other point. Oh, yes. In order to accomplish that, the line itself, the coupled line, is a quarter wavelength long. You get the maximum coupling between the straight through line and the coupling line when the coupled line is a quarter wavelength long at the operating frequency. The Berg wattmeter slug is much too small to give you enough real estate to do that. Therefore, the coupled line is much shorter than a quarter wave. That's got a slight disadvantage. The disadvantage is that you don't pick up as much signal. You can easily compensate that by making it a different coupling coefficient, moving the coupled line closer. Second of all, it's now going to have a slant to its characteristic. It's going to have more coupling at higher frequencies than lower frequencies. Berg gets around that by putting a frequency-sensitive network between the detector output and the actual meter. They put in a network in there that is a low-pass filter. Because the coupled line, being too short, picks up less signal for lower frequencies, the output coupling network has less insertion loss for lower frequencies. It's a 6 dB per octave roll-off on both the coupled line, and they make a 6 dB per octave roll-up on their frequency selective network that goes between the detector and the meter to make that all work out right. But you can see now,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
The one last point now, as I go to a slug that's operating at lower and lower power levels, instead of using the kilowatt slug, I use the 10-watt slug, so to speak. The way the 10-watt slug develops its greater sensitivity is that instead of it being a 40 dB coupler, it's a 30 dB coupler, if you know what I mean. In other words, the coupled line is closer in. As such, that internal termination, when you're in the reverse power mode, is going to be picking up more power. When I go from the 1,000-watt slug down to the 100-watt slug, I change my coupling coefficient by 10 dB. I have just increased by 10 dB the amount of power that goes into that internal termination, which, by the way, is inside that slug. So you go to the lower power slug because you want to accurately read the reverse power, which is very small, because you've got an almost perfectly matched antenna. There's two things wrong. Number one, you're more likely to burn up that slug because you're giving it the termination inside that slug, because the lower power slug is now getting a greater amount of power to its termination. Second of all, you're making the assumption that the lower power slug has the exact same directivity as the higher power slug. Therefore, if the higher power slug was trying to tell you that 1 watt is coming back, and now you want to read that more accurately, and you want to find out is it 9/10 of a watt or 1.1 watt, and you think you're going to read that on the lower power slug, because the lower power slug has a different directivity, you could call it a different calibration curve, you're probably not going to get the information that you want. That's about two-thirds of the story. Let's see if that made some sense, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Then I have a question.
Okay, Mel after John. You got it, John.
Oh, Dick, no, that answer is quite acceptable. I will be able to explain to them why now. I just wasn't sure of the exact reason, but I knew it could damage the slug, and I didn't know exactly why, but now I do. Very good. Thank you. I guess pass it over to Mel, Dick.
You got it, Mel.
Okay. You know, I noticed on a number of commercial L-band, for instance, amplifiers, that they have they build in a directional coupler. Is there a specific reason that it seems to be a standard piece of the, like, for instance, an L-band amplifier, Dick, over?
In the case of many solid-state amplifiers, which are very standing wave ratio sensitive, in other words, I might have an L-band amplifier in my hand that's good for 30 watts of output, for instance, and the manufacturer may tell you that it better not see more than a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, I think that means the reflection coefficient is a little bit shy of 10 dB. So if it's running 30 watts forward, there better be less than 3 watts coming back. Otherwise, the amplifier itself is subject to being damaged. So by putting a either forward-looking, reverse-looking, or both-looking directional coupler at the output of the amplifier, there's two or three things I can do with that. One, I could look at the indication of the forward coupling coupler, and I could confirm that the amplifier is now putting out 30 watts. That's telling me that it's in good health, I'm driving it hard enough, it's got the right power supply voltage, and so on. So sampling the forward voltage is one very good reason. A much bigger reason is now to also have a protection circuit in there that looks at reverse power. If that amplifier sees more than a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio when it's running 30 watts of power output, that means more than 3 watts of reflected power from the antenna, we'll say, is coming back to the output connector of that amplifier. And as that reflected power goes up, because the antenna becomes worse, because somebody is damaging it, so to speak, eventually you'll be hurting the amplifier. By sensing reverse power, I can build a protection network that either lights up a red light on the front panel or turns off one of the stages so that the amplifier either cuts itself back in power or turns itself off as a self-protect mode. So putting in directional couplers on the output stage of solid-state equipment, if you've got the real estate to do it, if you're smart enough and you've got the enthusiasm...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And if you've got the enthusiasm, it's an extremely good thing to do. It gives you a very valuable piece of information. Without disconnecting the amplifier and plugging it into a watt meter, in situ, in the working operation, you can be monitoring what the amplifier is doing and both power coming out of it and power being reflected back to it. So most of the circuits that I've worked on that are somewhat sensitive like that, I've added a directional coupler. Once you understand the theory of operation of a directional coupler, you'll be amazed how easy it is to add. The first article I ever published, way back in the dark ages of 1970, the amplifier triple, a strip line amplifier for 432 and 2 meters, had in its output network a power sampler, which allowed me to find out, was the amplifier putting out power? And by that power sampler going into a rectifier that came out to a meter on the front panel, I could turn the tuning and loading controls on the input and the output of that amplifier and peak up the power output. It's a very handy thing to have. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the second half.
I think you hit it right on that nail on the head, as they say. Because I noticed the output from the directional coupler was connected to a, was converted to a DC signal by a diode and a capacitor, and then fed to another network. So in other words, what they're doing, they were converting it to a DC voltage and then using that DC voltage back to give the whatever indication or the protection for the amplifier. I believe that must be the design, Dick, over.
Dick, how big is this thing, WS to M1?
In some cases, Paul, the directional coupler we're talking about at the output of an amplifier could be amazingly small. In other words, from my printed circuit board, I may have a nice fat piece of wire going up to the type N connector. That's, let's say, a half inch or a quarter inch away, the center conductor of the type N connector. And that's coupling power output from the printed circuit board to the center conductor of the type N connector that is on the wall of the box that the amplifier is contained in. Along the length of that piece of wire coming from the printed circuit board or on the printed circuit board itself, I could have a parallel piece of wire, or maybe an eighth of an inch away, maybe a quarter of an inch long, which is the pickup coupler. Just a parallel piece of wire for a short distance, parallel to the main signal coupling conductor, will pick up that signal. And if you properly terminate that piece of wire with the right number of ohms of resistance on one end and your diode rectifier on the other end, you will now get a sample voltage, which is telling you something about the power output of your amplifier going forward, or depending on how you hook it up, the power being reflected back from your amplifier. It's an extremely simple thing to add once you understand the theory of operation. So by magnetic means primarily, it is sampling the signal going on your main conductor and giving you an indication. And that can be very valuable information. That voltage that Mel was talking about could go into some kind of a Schmitt trigger thresholding device that when the voltage exceeded the amount equal to a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, it trips the Schmitt trigger, which in turn turns on a protection circuit, turns on a red light, warning light on the front panel, whatever. So they're amazingly easy to do, Paul.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So back to you for some fill on that, Paul. WS2N? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, understood. Very good. Yeah, what threw me was when you mentioned real estate. You know, I'm wondering maybe it was an external component that had to be, you know, I'm envisioning maybe coils, tuning capacitors. You know, when I heard that word, I said, well, how big is this thing? Okay, understood. Very good. I got it, Dick. Back to you.
I'm glad you said what you did, Paul. When you talked about coils and capacitors and whatever, it brings to mind the standing wave ratio monitoring equipment that you will see as a schematic diagram and as a construction article in the ARRL antenna manual. In that particular case, that machine, which usually has a toroid coil with a piece of the coax cable going through the center of it, and another toroid coil monitoring voltage at a slightly different location, it's a fairly elaborate circuit with two separate toroids, a whole lot of resistors, capacitors, rectifiers, switching networks, and whatever. A fairly elaborate network for standing wave ratio monitoring is the circuit that you've seen in the antenna handbook. Bear in mind that that particular machine is trying to cover a whole lot of octaves of frequency. Depending on the design, it may try to operate between the 160 meter ham band at roughly 1.5 megacycles, 1.6 or 7 megacycles, all the way up to 30 megacycles. It's covering I think it's more than a decade. It's a whole lot of frequency range. That's a much more elaborate circuit. When you and I build a L-band amplifier with 30 watts of output, and the thing operates from 1,000 to 1,500 megacycles, you know, it's only got a few percent of bandwidth, then the directional coupler you use can be much, much simpler. Also, when it comes to real estate, it's obvious, let me drop this, that the total amount of volume you've got to operate with on the inside of the slug of a bird watt meter is very little real estate. And yet they managed to squeeze in there all of the circuitry that does this. A simple piece of wire that runs parallel to your main line, a built-in termination, probably a rectifier, and somewhere along the line is a frequency-sensitive circuit, which is usually built into the slug itself, which compensates for the fact that the coupled line inside the slug is too small, therefore it's got this roll-off frequency characteristic as you go down in frequency. And they have to put in a filter network that does the opposite in order to make it flat. That's one of the main reasons why when you look at a bird watt meter slug, printed onto the front cover of that thing is a frequency region over which it is rated. And if you use the bird slug outside of that frequency region, within reason, nothing bad happens. It doesn't explode, it doesn't smoke, nothing bad happens. You go out of calibration, but there's nothing stopping you from recalibrating it for that frequency region. If I was using a slug that was rated from 1,000 to 2,000 megs, and I decide to use it at 500 megs, with a couple of simple tests I could do in my shack, let me drop, I might discover that this 1,000 to 2,000 megacycle rated slug, let's assume it's a 100 watt full-scale slug, I intend to use it at 500 megs instead of the desired frequency region, I might find out that it gives 80% of the normal reading. And with a little bit of testing, I could find out that the 80% goes between 79 and 81% as I go up and down in power output at 500 megs. So I guarantee, if you're willing to do a little bit of recalibrating of your particular serial number slug, you can use it very far outside of the frequency region and find out what it's doing. As I said, nothing really bad happens, just the calibration will be different, and you can easily form that. Anybody with any further questions or comments on these subjects so far, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RFM.
Go right ahead, Alan. And I know. Also, stop telling us about your experiment if you want to. You got it, Alan.
Okay. My question is really very tangential. It was something you had mentioned in response to what Mel had said about a setting up a threshold circuit. You said you would use something like a Schmitt trigger to do the comparison. Did you mean just a comparator? Would a comparator be just enough for something like what you're talking about? Because I always saw the Schmitt trigger as something for debouncing an external signal, like a push button or something along those lines.
A comparator is a much better word for what I was talking about. A comparator is really a kind of an operational amplifier, where on one terminal, which I would call the reference, you put some kind of a voltage, which is your threshold voltage. I might put plus 1 volt on the reference terminal of a comparator. Then my sensing terminal will give me maybe a zero output if I'm less than 1 volt, and as I exceed 1 volt, the output of the comparator will become a 1. It's a logic circuit. A Schmitt trigger really is, a comparator really is a Schmitt trigger. Just that a Schmitt trigger is the earlier, older words that were set up back in the days when people used to build individual transistorized logic circuits. You take a pair of transistors, you can make a balanced amplifier. Using them in a particular way, it becomes a Schmitt trigger. Use it in slightly different biasing, it becomes a monostable multivibrator. Use it with slightly different biasing again, it becomes a stable multivibrator, better known as oscillator, and so on. So a pair of transistors operating as a differential amplifier as a balanced amplifier, a differential amplifier, depending on how you bias it, depending on how you connect the feedback, can be any of those old-fashioned logic circuits. But nowadays, we just go out and buy this little chip called comparator, and it does the job very nicely. Just as long as you don't exceed its ratings. I mean, when used as a comparator, they may tell you that the reference terminal shouldn't go higher than plus 10 or lower than minus 5, so to speak, depending on how you're using it and what power supply voltages you're giving it. But you've got the right idea. And once you set up one of these comparators correctly to act as a protection circuit for your amplifier, it can avoid an awful lot of grief. Let me drop. Because in most cases, when you abuse an amplifier, you're doing something that usually creates overheating at the final stage. And the overheating at the final stage is eventually going to create damage. Depending on the nature of the overheating, the damage might occur in a microsecond, a millisecond, a second, depending on what kind of magnitude of feedback. And are you creating secondary breakdown because you reflected too much voltage? Are you reflecting the wrong impedance so that the final stage draws too much current and it's creating extra heating? And because it's got some thermal mass to it, it can take that abusive heating for a certain length of time, which might be 15 seconds, so to speak. So once you get smart enough on the potential forms of damage of your final stage, and once you know the vulnerability of your final stage, you can decide how to set up the timing. You could set up a comparator in such a way that it doesn't turn off the amplifier or doesn't light its warning light until a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio has been exceeded for 5 solid seconds. And you could put some fancy resets in there and so on to make sure you're not getting a false alarm because the wind is blowing your antenna and occasionally it touches the limb of a tree, but it's a brief event and it's not worth it occurs for such a short period of time that it couldn't damage your amplifier. You see there's various ways you can set these things up. But to build a solid-state amplifier without protection networks is usually risky, but there's a catch. Let me drop. Most of the manufacturers of the handy talkies that we own have done it the other way around. They've made sure that the final stage is so beefy that maybe it's rated for 10 watts of power output, but you're only really using it at 3.5 watts of output. And as such, it's got a big enough internal heat sink, it's got enough capability such that your handy talkie in most cases can tolerate a dead short circuit or complete open circuit indefinitely without damage. That's the best kind of protection in the world. You've made the final stage so beefy that you can't damage it in the worst case. Now you don't have to waste any time with protection circuits. Well, with modern day transistors and the low amount of power that a handy talkie works, that's pretty easy to do. If you're running a state-of-the-art 10 gigahertz solid-state amplifier, and you need to use it for moon balance, and I was having discussions with guys on the phone on just that subject today, and you're trying to get 40 watts of output of solid-state power on 10,000 megacycles with the transistors that are available to you, most likely you're using at the 98% power output capability of those transistors. And therefore, they're right on the threshold of damage when they got a good load. And you better have a very, very sensitive protection network in there that senses the fact that anything is starting to go wrong if you want to protect those very, very expensive final stage transistors. So depending on how conservative you are, it makes a strong difference on how much protection you need. KC2RFN, K2RIW in a second. You got it, John. Correction, Alan.
KC2RFN. Yeah, the question John asked and the answers you're giving are very timely. I've been doing a lot of playing around with my wire antennas, and I've gotten used to getting on the rig and just turning on the antenna tuner and talking. And today, I went on there and I started talking, and I just assumed the SWR was good because it had been good. But when I decided to look at the meter, I saw a line shooting across that I wasn't used to seeing, and the SWR was going off the scale, but it wasn't shutting down the transmitter yet. And I said, you know, I'm going to need something that's going to tell me when, you know, kind of a fail-safe, when all of a sudden I'm out of tune. And I couldn't understand why. I hadn't changed anything. And sure enough, when I checked the transmission wire, I just started working it, starting from the transmitter end out to the antenna, And of course, I found I'm having some construction done on my house, and someone had yanked on the cable and pulled it, pulled most of the insulation from the shield, and probably damaged some of the shield as it goes through the input into my house. So it would be nice to have some sort of fail-safe system, because these little things happen all the time. And like you mentioned, with the wind blowing and all that, that also knocked out another connector I had. And then there I am pumping on very high SWR, whereas in the day before it was fine.
Before I forget, did Frank get a hold of you, Alan? The reason I'm asking that question is I gave him your email address. I didn't have your phone number. He would have liked to...
AMG?
He would have liked to talk to you on the phone. Go ahead, Alan.
What Frank are you talking about?
Mr. Frank Fallon, N2FF, does want to have a conversation with you. If you would mail me an email with your telephone number on it, that would be very helpful. Back to you, Alan.
Yeah, the last time I spoke to Frank was the Ham University, last February, so he hasn't contacted me at all yet. No problem. I'll email that to you tonight or tomorrow.
Very good. So, did you get a chance to use that RG6 piece of cable, the cable television cable, that was disconnected at the utility pole end but still went to your house, and you were thinking of using that as a fraction of an antenna? I wonder if you had a chance to do that experiment yet, Alan. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I traced out the line again, and I disconnected the line that was already at my house. And when I disconnected it, I noticed that I lost my computer internet service. So when I reconnected, of course, it came back. So the line was actually live, but it was confusing because when I go to the other side of the house, which is where I thought my live cable was coming into, that also was live. So I actually have two live feeds from the cable company into both ends of my house. So I looked up the pole again, but this time with a pair of binoculars, which is something you suggested last week, and that's a really great idea, by the way. It's very, very convenient, a great little trick. And I found out what I thought was my line terminating, just hanging there, was not mine. It was one of my neighbors. So it's a good thing I didn't put anything through it. But let me just drop for a second. KC2 RFN. So I called up the cable company, and I spoke with they sent me to the service department. I said, how come I have two lines coming in from separate parts of the house? I'd never seen that before. And they said, more than likely, they just didn't feel like running the lines from one side of the house to the other, so they just gave me another drop. But they did say it's very, very unusual to have two drops. So unfortunately, unless I can think of a way for them to bring me another drop, a third drop that I won't use, I'm going to be out of luck on getting that 60-foot line going across the street. But then I eyeballed the telephone lines, those box lines that are shooting across the street, and then I'm going to go, I wonder if I might be able to use those. But I imagine that's probably prohibitive. But maybe it's worth trying. Maybe somebody out there knows about the system.
I think I see what's going on here, Alan. Your house is so big that from the east side to the west side, if they did internal wiring for the cable TV, they'd have to be digging so many holes in the walls and the ceiling and everything else and going through the basement and whatever. It would be such an elaborate job that it's much easier to bring in a line from the outside, from each side of your house. That's what they did. I'm only slightly joking on this one. In the case of your POTS lines, if they're not being used, if they really aren't open circuit at the far end, I think you could use them as an RF circuit. On top of that, I'm realizing something else. A really crafty amateur who's a little bit on the illegal side could go out and buy a piece of cable that looks identical to the kind of drop cable that the cable TV company uses, run it from his house over to the utility pole, connect it to nothing, and use that as a support for an antenna. As I said, you're breaking rules to do this, but I'll bet you there have been hams that have been tried who have tried things like that. Back to you for any comments, Alan, K2RIW.
Yeah, I thought about that, and I nixed it. You know, with my luck.